If you could all join me in the serenity prayer, we'll get the meeting started again. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I am, and the wisdom to know the difference. If I can do, like to introduce our meeting, for our speaker for tonight, Thomas and Anna.
My name is Tom. I'm an alcoholic. And wherever Jordan is, thank you for asking me to come speak at your group this evening. And I asked him how that had happened. Apparently, I'm still on a speaker list up in the central office up in Santa Ana. And it was kind of ironic because I got called to speak at a meeting in Carlsbad about 2 weeks ago. Last time I was called off that list was probably three, maybe years ago. I'm not a circuit speaker, so if you have expectations, you're going to be greatly disappointed. And welcome to the newcomers. I think I counted four. I don't remember much as far as names go, but I know you're in that general vicinity over there. And welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope that when you've walked through these doors that you'll continue to come back through them without drinking. It's certainly been a change in my life and one for the better. There's a lot of things to cover, and I'll give you a couple of little, goofy details, which really don't mean much, but they are what they are. I'm 53 years old. I have an entourage of peers that have known me for a long time, so I can't really lie up here. I'm going to have to be honest and give you some straight stuff. I'm about 5'10" and about 204 pounds, and I could go under 200 on any given moment. I could go to 250 at any moment. Who knows? But anyway, those are the physical statistics. I was introduced into Alcoholics Anonymous in April of 1980 and have not had a drink since then. I'm 53 years old. I've enjoyed 31 years of sobriety. That time does not matter. The fact that I got up this morning, didn't have a drink, and I really haven't even felt like having one, that does matter. And that makes me the same as the new guys and anybody else in this room. If you all came out this morning and decided you weren't going to drink, or made that decision, or tuned in with your higher power, however it is that you do what you do to stay sober, we're on the same page today. And that's the great thing I like about this program. There's no greatness in this program. There's sobriety. And sobriety is the greatness we share. God, I'm going to ping pong all over the ballpark here. Again, I told you I'm not a circuit speaker, so things are going to come flying out of the woodwork, out of the ceilings and all that stuff. This is the house of God. Don't worry, lightning won't come in. I think I did my steps well, cleaned everything up. if it does come through the door, duck. Because it'll be coming at me, I'm sure, because I was the worst of the worst. We all feel that way. The new guys, new folks that are in here, I remember being in the meetings new and what that seat felt like. And I kind of consider it like a hot plate, a frying pan or something. There was times that I could not sit. I don't sit well to begin with. I have the attention span of a gnat. Okay, I just don't do well with having to sit and concentrate and listen to people get up here and do whatever it is they do. That seat got hot. There were people that would sit there and put their arm on my shoulder and tell me to just stay seated and to listen. Well, for me to listen is hard to do. I think for any alcoholic, it's hard to listen because we're doing things our own way for so long that when we got here, we still wanted to do things our way, and it kind of lays it out in 12 steps and what we should probably do to be better people. So it takes a while to get used to listening. So if you're in that seat and it's hot or you're nervous or whatever, that's, bless you, that's more of an indication that you're in the right place. And I will tell you again that I'm glad you're all here, all of us for that matter. As I said, in April of 1980, I was introduced to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Prior to that, I was the oldest of three kids, grown up in a Catholic family, with the vision of me being a priest. I'm obviously not a priest. I failed and certainly went down a path that was not going to get me too far in that into those areas. Maybe a good thing. I don't know. First time I drank, and these are just going to draw these things out of the back of my mind, I was 12 years old. Couldn't tell you the exact date. I have friends that can tell you exact dates about what times they did things. I just have general dates. But sometime during the time that I was 12 years old, I discovered that My neighbor that lived next door, and I lived in Colorado at the time, was a foreman at Coors Brewery, and what they did is they gave these guys cases of beer on Fridays when they go home. They throw them in the trunk. Well, this guy had his whole garage. You know, this is an alky's dream, but I'm 12 years old. I don't know any different. Garage was lined with cases of beer. You know, the garage door's up. I'd bet there was probably 70, 80 cases of beer in there, and you just keep putting them in the refrigerator. But, you know, like any good alcoholic, and maybe he was, maybe he wasn't, he didn't have enough. You know, and as far as I was concerned, it was the best thing ever, the job that I got, because they told me that they wanted me to feed their dog and their cat while they went away on vacation for 2 weeks. So, of course, like anybody else, and I don't know if you guys ever did this, but when you were young, did you ever look in anybody's refrigerator when you had to feed the cat and the dog? Get honest. You got to. Medicine cabinets, drawers, junk drawer, okay, all that stuff. Well, I looked in the guy's refrigerator, and of course he's got cold Coors in the refrigerator, and like I'm thinking that might be kind of cool, because I remember him and my dad drinking them when they were barbecuing during the summers and stuff. And I wanted to be cool like my dad and him and everybody else that drank Coors in Colorado. So I, you know, popped one. That wasn't enough. Popped two. Popped a couple more after 4 7-ounce cans. That's what they were at the time. Those of you who are old enough might remember them. But at 12 years old and 28 ounces of beer, I felt it a little bit. Went home and did whatever it is I was going to do, but couldn't wait to go feed the darn dog the next day. And they were gone for 2 weeks, so... Is that binge drinking? I'm not sure, but I did drink a lot of Coors, and I was restocking it because I was certain that with the 70 or 80 or however many cases were on that wall, he wasn't going to notice if I was restocking the refrigerator. And I can't tell you how many of them I had, but I was increasing my intake as the weeks went by. What was irritating to me was when they came back from vacation, and I didn't have that rite of passage to go in there. You know, back of my mind is saying, you know, when are you going to go on vacation again? The front of my mind is saying is, you need a vacation right now. But that was how it got underway. I did not start drinking on a daily basis, but I resorted to doing other things because I kind of liked it. But my buddies and I would walk around at night, and a lot of people used to just leave their garage doors open. So the idea was to run in and get the beer out of the refrigerator in the garage. And that was kind of a truth or dare thing, but I was always the idiot amongst my friends that would want to do it, and I did it. On one occasion, I'd done one house a few too many times, apparently, and they were rigged up ready for me. Garage door went down behind me, and when I saw it going down, all I saw was my buddy's legs running away. I'm like, oh, no, this isn't a good thing, and I go to go in the house, and some guy's like going to do this. And so the upside was I was, you know, faster than a rabbit when I was scared, and I probably still could be if I was scared. Nobody'd catch me when I'm scared. And I ran, and I didn't turn around, and I'm, you know, 12, 13 years old at the time, and I'm just running, and I'm not looking back because at first I'm hearing footsteps. Then I'm not hearing footsteps anymore. I'm hearing them again, but it's just what's going on in the back of my head. I probably ran full speed ahead at, you know, for maybe a mile at like 6,000 feet is where we lived in Colorado. And when I finally turned around, there was nothing back there, nothing at all. And I thought I made a clean escape, you know, and I wanted to find out why buddies didn't yell at me to say the garage door was going down or to do something about it. But nonetheless, that was... You know, I ran through the house to get away, by the way, too. I didn't mention that, but the guy tried to grab me, and I went out for a door. So at least I went out the right way. I came in the wrong way. But anyway, these are the stupid things that happen to alcoholics. I did a lot of other stupid things, too. Like, you know, when I got a little bit older and got a driver's license, didn't hesitate to go out with my buddies and drink Boone's Farm, Strawberry Ridge, or Spinata. You know, if you could drink it out of a bottle, it was good. If you drink it out of a glass, you're corny. You can't do that. That's not good, okay? So that was kind of the entry into the wine thing. Champagne didn't do it for me. Gave me a stomachache. Just went on to bigger and better things. Hard liquor. Tequila seemed to kind of get it done pretty good. I always seemed to find a way to get looped out pretty good on tequila. Regardless of what it is, and I couldn't probably name off brands and stuff like that, but typically it was what I could steal off the shelf in some store because I wasn't old enough. Or at the time, in this area, was one of the areas, and there's probably still a lot of Marines around here. We called them jarheads. One of my best friends is an ex-jarhead. But it's but those of you that are, thank you for your service, and I'm not making fun of you, but that's what we used to do as kids, to say, let's go down to the Shirley's Market and let's get the, you know, jarheads to go in and buy us something. And that's how we used to get it back then, too. Resorted to other things, alcoholic and I am another one of those things, too. Just another way to alter my mind and not to, you know, to get me away from the reality of what was going on in the world. I wasn't I wasn't a stupid kid, I just did stupid things. I was actually probably a pretty bright kid. And when applying myself when I was younger, I could certainly pull down grades, which may not have been an indication of anything other than that I could concentrate and was trying to please my parents. When I got tired of pleasing my parents and the alcoholic in me spiked up, then I started doing all the things that I thought were right. Alcoholism does funny things to people, and in families it causes great, duress and stress and different things like that. As I was growing through my stages and such, and the oldest of three, my father would always look at me as like, you're supposed to be an example here. By the way, my sister's sober about 28 years, I think, now, but she came in a few years after I did. You can see the example I set for her. I mean, the reality is that alcoholism was in the both of us. That's what happened. But my dad probably did the greatest favor that he ever did for me in my life, and, he's gone now. But on my 18th birthday, in his sarcastic way, he actually had a gift wrapped up for me. And you got to remember, I'd had some run-ins with the juvenile hall and all that stuff, because at 18 you don't go to jail unless you do something really super major, but I was certainly starting to head down that path. 18 years old, he gives me this wrapped up present and says, open it, my 18th birthday. So I go in and I open it up, and it's a plate, fork, knife, and spoon in a plastic glass, and he tells me it's time to move out now. Okay, so this is the way we do things, though. I got to be cool. Like, no problem. I'm thinking, but in the back of my head, I'm like, who's going to let me sleep on the floor at their house? Or is that car going to be that comfortable? Or what am I going to do? But he's kind of looking at me, probably waiting for a reaction. Of course, I'm not going to give it to him because I'm a smart kid, right? I'm 18 years old. I'm an adult now. I told him it's no problem. My mom, she's been like, we got to do something. We got to do something. And my dad did something. My dad might have saved my life, because basically what happened from that time that eviction, we'll call it, occurred to the time that I got sober, 18, I got sober at 21, I basically just pinned the accelerator, so to speak, just flat out just went crazy. There was no governor out there on me now. Now I'm going nuts, okay? And I'm putting everything I can into me that I can get my hands on and doing stupid things that you do when you trying to put that stuff in, and I wasn't beyond stealing, I wasn't beyond cheating, I wasn't beyond lying. I worked jobs, and I did my job and got paid to do those things, but that didn't seem to be enough. As the acceleration went on and stuff, I had more and more encounters with the law. Some of them were pretty stupid, but not one of the seven incarcerations that I had. They were all short-termers. Never one of them was I sober. I was always in trouble for something. I fought a little bit, but I was always drunk. Or on drunk and something else, whatever it was. And those were the kinds of things that really take your life and just you start to ask yourself questions. Now, I used to fight with people. And I mean, when I first got sober, this gives you an idea of what happens when you come here. You got to get honest. That's the one thing. And maybe it isn't totally honest when you get here. If somebody asked me, if I said, well, I used to fight all the time, how'd you do out there? Well, I had 73 fights and I won 72 and one was a draw. Reality is, if I had 72 fights, I probably lost 70 of them. It's not true. I didn't win any of them. And here's kind of how the mind works. Let me clarify how that works. I might have got the better of a couple of these guys, and a lot of these guys got the better of me. The reality was that I had a tremendous guilt that was carried with me after the fact that when I would get one of those guys, when I'd hurt some guy. This is the way my mind would work, and this is, I think, the way an alcoholic's mind worked. If I hurt the guy, really hurt him bad, I want to go back and apologize. I'd want to put him back together. If he beat me up, I want to have another shot at going back and getting him. Probably so I could go back and feel bad if I really got him again. It's insane. That's insane thinking. But that's the way my head worked. I do have a new grill. I actually, after I got sober, I saved my money and I got new teeth, because my teeth were really, a lot of them got dinged out during those fighting days. Irrelevant. And probably the other things I was putting in my body didn't do it. And good oral hygiene was not a high priority when I was drinking. Amazing. Things change when we get sobered up. I don't know where I'm going with this thing, so let me draw here for a second. Are you guys relating with anything I'm saying up here? Or is this like... All right.
Yeah, you can take it.
Sometimes things get going down the road where you just start to wonder when it's all going to end, and you start to wonder, how can you stop doing these things that you're doing because they're insane? You know they're insane, and some people are telling them they're insane, but you're going to run with a group of people that tell you it's cool or that it's okay. So, you know, you don't know. I'm going to tell you what I was doing. You probably will relate with this. And if I say you know too many times, some of you guys start sticking your hands up saying, you said you know again, because I'm just trying to get you to agree with me. I'm not selling anything up here. I'm just giving you my story, so just understand that. But running around out there and doing the things that I was doing and catch those things catching up, there's a group of guys that I run with or people that I run with that are like, you know, that's really cool. You know, and when I had the junk or the money or whatever it was and I was doing what I was doing and partying it up, those guys were always around. When I ran out of money and was scraping, I couldn't get a hold of them. They didn't want to be around me. I didn't have anything, you know. So these guys are saying it's, you know, cool to be doing what you're doing. Once in a while, you pop in on the parental units and stuff, and they are like going, you're a wreck. You know, you're a menace to society or whatever, and you think about the times you've been going to jail, and you think about being on probation and the stupid things that you're doing, and the fighting and, you know, not knowing how you got home or just all the stupid stuff. It starts to weigh. It weighed on me really heavily, and it to the point where I was like starting to ask myself a question, you know, are you going to die today? You know, there was a point, and I don't want to say I'm suicidal because I'm not suicidal. I love life, and I really loved life even back then. Obviously enough to get to the point where I was thinking what I was doing, but I'm out flying a little plane over the Pacific Ocean, throwing the nose over the thing going, that's enough of this, I'm done. And for whatever reason, pull out of it and don't put it into the big blue Pacific at whatever speed the wings rip off and you die, I don't know. I made a decision. Another decision that I made, you know, back then was to save my life or to stop trying to kill myself. There came a time in my life where it was. The worst part about it was the months and months and months, what seemed like years and years and years of time that I spent getting up in the morning saying, God, don't let me do this again. Sometimes you go 30, 45, 1 hour, and you're in. Because you just can't do it. Kind of relates to like quitting smoking or quitting heroin. I don't know. I mean, you know, it's hard to stop doing things. Alcohol is not easy to stop doing if you're an alcoholic. Because I had 1,000 reasons why I should keep doing it. Anyway, it was miserable. And the misery just continued to go on. And I'm going to say it went on for probably, it was probably a 6-month stint that I was going through this thing, waking up in the mornings and, you know, resorting, you know, there I said, you know, you guys are supposed to stop me when I'm doing this too, by the way. Waking up in the mornings and telling yourself, you can't do this again. Resorting whatever it is your parents gave you as far as religion and trying to get an understanding of a God and saying, God, help me, don't let me do this again. I'm destroying what I might know as far as a faith or reliance on a higher power. This is prior to getting sober. And I'm going back and doing the very thing that I'm trying not to do anymore. I think that's called insanity. And I would get up and do those things during the course of a day, day in and day out for months. And it got worse and worse and worse. And the acceleration of my drinking got worse and worse and worse. It's kind of like when you're seeing the finish line you're going to run, but I didn't know where the finish line was. That was a 6-month probably run. Don't know the exact dates. But I can tell you that it was horrible. It was absolutely horrible. Now, at the time that this was all happening, I was resorted to living in the back of a 78 Toyota Corolla, which was home, and it ran well. I actually kind of held down a job and was getting paid to do certain things, but every paycheck that I got went to whatever it was that got me away from being real or whatever. So I'm doing what I do and driving in the car, endangering everybody's life that's driving down the road around me, thinking that I've got it all wired up, you know, racing through the 555 interchange at like 55, 60 miles an hour. At the time, it was like an S-type turn that said 25. I just thought if you just treated it like the S's on a racetrack, you could just kind of go straight on through there. And I pretty much did that, got the first turn down pretty good, went through the second one, went head on into the guardrail at 55 or 60 miles an hour. I'm talking about the point of the guardrail, not the edge of it. I went into the point where it comes into the end, and car does this, and back in comes up. Two-piece axle comes up, pops up next to me, and car wedges up on the guardrail, and so now I'm at a reality strike, because I really didn't know even how I got to that point, other than that wakes you up. You know, the Gumby effect when you're drunk. You know, it's kind of like some, it's not like somebody pokes you in the ribs. It's like somebody slugs you in the side of the head. Like, whoa, did that really happen? Yeah, it did. So I'm out there, and I would call it trying to vibrate the car off the guardrail, because I'm a smart guy. I'm figuring, you know, hey, this doesn't feel like it's shifting into reverse at all, and it's just making a lot of noise. I'm going to vibrate off, and then I can just vibrate down the road. Kind of lose track of time when you're in that state of mind. And the state of mind that I was in was that, you know, going to get out of this one because I'm invincible. And I went right back to that stupid, ignorant, alcoholic, drunken thinking that I had. I maybe tried to vibrate off a guardrail for 4 or 5 minutes. I'm not sure. Maybe 10. However long it took the CHP to get there, I didn't get the thing off the guardrail and vibrate down the road in time to get away from that. And when I did get the door open to step out of the car, I forgot that the car was up on a guardrail, so I just went, And I kind of look up, and there's the CHP, and he's standing there going, how are you this evening? And I'm thinking to myself, typical answer, fine. Not knowing or not really thinking much about the fact that I'm now homeless because I was living in the car. County of Orange and the Highway Patrol provided me accommodations for the evening after I failed their elementary school test of doing the alphabet or whatever. Just another one of those things. Problem was that I had prior stuff that was going on in my life, and I was actually on a probation with Los Angeles County, and they were having me come down for regular appearances to give them little examples or samples of what I'd been doing that week or 2 weeks prior to my visit to the probation office. I went to the Orange County Jail. Now, there's a time that everything comes to a head. Now, I'm thinking I was going to get out of these things, but I'm knowing that I'm not going to get out of them. This was incarceration number 7. And I've got a world of issues that are going on in legally with me because I've had failed tests, urine tests, they give me a test. I was failing the tests with the County of Los Angeles. And I'm in the jail, and I know that that's what's going to happen, is that there's going to be some serious problems because I had issues with the law. And I was breaking the law. I was breaking what they'd given me, which was lenient compared to what I should have got. For whatever reason, they let me out on my own recognizance, which is prior to the computer age, and I got out. And I called my dad, who basically F-bombed the daylights out of me, which I deserved every one of them, and told him about what it was, and he's like, good, your mom said you can come home and have a shower. Now let's see if you relate to this one. What's the longest shower you're ever going to take in life? The one after you get out of jail, because it's going to wash away everything that's wrong that got you in jail. I can tell you that I ran the hot water out of the heater, and I was not cleansed because it didn't go away. I asked my mom, my mom came and she said to me, you know, well, you've got some issues, and I've been talking to some people. My dad's just, you know, F-bombing his way through the kitchen with his cup of coffee, but he's kind of going along with my mom. I didn't realize either until later on after I did some amends work how much friction I had caused between my parents, and probably how close they came to divorce, because he can't be out on the streets. The hell he can't. Yes, no, yes, no. He'd go travel on the road. I'd come home and do laundry. Hey, can I sleep on the back patio? No, you can go sleep in the bed. Your dad will be home on Friday. Little sister goes in. Hey, guess who stayed over here this week? Ah, there they go again, but I'm not there for it. I let out the gopher gasser in the house, but I'm not there to see it when they all smell it, right? You know what I mean? I'm just, everything I do in my life is a wreck. My mom tells me there's a place to go, and I end up going to a alcohol recovery unit. kind of a famous little picture you see around some of our meeting halls and stuff, or is one drunk talking to another. I got two that sat down and told me their stories. And didn't want to act like I understood what they were saying, but I understood virtually every word of it. Because they talked about pain. They talked about guilt, remorse. It's like the seven deadly sins were coming up and all the stuff I'd learned being a Catholic kid and all that stuff. These were daggers that were flying into me. And it was reality. And they didn't do it out of trying to make me feel uncomfortable, although I felt horrible, like my seat was on fire. I was in a frying pan. They did it to save my life, which is what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous when somebody's willing. And apparently I was willing. Now, the one thing that happened in the jail when I was in there is that I had my head up on those bars. They have glass now, by the way. Later story, I'll tell you why I know that. But I had my head up on those bars, and there's a prayer that I've utilized with great frequency in the time that I've been sober that comes up, and sometimes at the darkest moments of my life. Because when I was in that jail, I knew there was issues that were going to go. And I had a lot of things that I had to deal with. And the prayer was really simple. And maybe you guys will tuck this one away. The good thing is it's short and I can remember it because I can't remember anything anymore. God help me. But say it with sincerity and see what happens. It was pretty simple. And to myself, God help me. That wasn't a prayer that I utilized very often because he's going to get me out of this. I'll never do it again. I promise if we get out of this one, we'll never. I did not say that. I said, God help me. I asked God to help me. And apparently sincerely enough that I found this path into this hospital. And I met some guys in there and stuff, and they all basically spent time with me. Some of them were new guys, and there was actually people working in there that had some real time that were working a program and stuff, and they were kind of guiding me along. And thank God that I got to know those people, which I still do know them today. Thank God. Probably the greatest thing I learned in the time that I was in that hospital happened on the day that I was getting ready to go. And the guy that had pretty much been the carrot dangler about sobriety out in front of me and stuff put his arms around me and he said very quietly in my ear, if you don't go to meetings when you leave here, you won't make it. You need to go to meetings. And I took his word for it, and I did attend meetings. And I went quite often to meetings. It's amazing what happens. Now, the issues that we're dealing with the law and all that stuff, there were some things that got cleaned up with those, and I was able to remain out of jail, not be incarcerated, and continue to follow the path of sobriety. It doesn't really get all that good, and we don't really get as honest as we should be, but we do stay around this program. It's going to rub off on you. Now, the first day that I got out of the hospital, I did go to a meeting. I followed this guy's directions to the T. Some of my peers that were still not released from that hospital were at this meeting. So what do we do when we go out in the parking lot? It's a meeting of AA, but I'm going to say it anyway. These guys smoke dope, and what do? I go over there and smoke it. You want to feel guilt after being sober for 24 days and doing something that you know you're not supposed to be doing? Just try it. I guess retreading is another word that can happen here. That one scared me probably more than anything because I had sort of had some of the fog starting to clear in my head. I was clean. And on the other hand, I just did something to dirty up my chalkboard one more time. And there were things called guilt and all that stuff that was going on. I was letting down all these people. But the overwhelming one that was in there was fear. Was this going to be the trigger that set the dominoes off that went all the way to the end that put me in the ground, which at one time didn't seem like a bad alternative, or continue to go through that miserable thing, that 6 months that led up to the time that I finally got sober? I didn't want any part of it. I continued to go to meetings. But as far as talking about what I did in the parking lot, I trusted that my friends weren't going to say anything because they're going to be as much trouble as I was. But I sat there at meetings in 30 days from the day that I went into the hospital, which was about 6 days clean. Anybody get a 30-day chip? Boom, 60, boom, 90, boom. I talked to a guy that I met in meetings a little after 90 days. I go, this doesn't feel good anymore. Apparently what was happening in those meetings, and I was going to him every day, was rubbing off on me, and he said, why? And I told him why. He says, well, maybe you better clean it up. So I thought I might, you know, get my eviction notice from AA or something if I went in and talked, but to the group that I was a part of. I didn't realize that's part of what we do here in this program, is we are honest because we're going to educate our fellow alcoholics, our brothers, our sisters in this program, about the things we have to do to stay sober. And I let it off the hook. I thought, you know, I was probably the first person in history to ever do it. I wasn't, obviously not. And anybody that's been around here more than a few months knows that that happens quite often. The thing I'll go back to and the thing that I'll say is the most important thing that at least I felt out there was that fear that it was going to set it off one more time and I might not get that chance. I don't know if any of you guys that are new in here have tried this thing before and you're back again. God, if this is your chance, you know, you don't know how many you're going to get. And I don't know how many I'm going to get. If I picked one up now, I don't know. Haven't wanted to for a long time. And really, the life that I've come to know at this particular point would be a horrible mistake to even tamper with the idea of doing it. Anyway, told you I've been sober since April of 1980, which is no big deal, but I haven't told you anything I've done when I've been sober. I lived instead of died. I'm living instead of dying. And a lot of things have, you know, occurred in that time frame. And this is where the memory gets bad, you know, where you can't remember anything anymore. You start getting older and all that. But I've had some great opportunities that have been placed in front of me as a result of this program by working the steps and doing the things that I do. And I've had a lot of things that happen in life that have come to me, good, bad, and indifferent. I've learned how to deal with them. I've worked the steps. First time through on 4 and 5, not so good. Got it out there, but I don't know, you hear people talk about peeling the layers back on an onion. First time through, there was, you know, what do they say, hanging on to the worst items in stock or whatever when we do an inventory. Those things kind of come up and get you too, and that'll create fears and you know, no, you don't, you know again, you guys are supposed to stop me, okay? You do know, but I'm not trying to sell you on this. I'm going to tell you that it causes great fear inside of me if I don't disclose what it is that I've got going on inside of me. Those are cancers. Those are the things that eat me up from the inside out. Those are the things that cause me to do things that I really don't want to do. Now, if I do enough of them and accumulate enough of them as I did prior to coming into this program, there is a chance that I will go back to doing the very things that were killing me, that were causing me to have a life where I was dying instead of living. Early on in this program and stuff, I started in a business or was working in a business where I just learned something from the ground floor up and started to work through those, I guess, building the bricks in the wall of whatever it is that you learn how to do in a business. Today, my best friend runs that business. What do I do now? I kind of I run the business with him, but not directly. I've taken up new hobbies. I race cars. It's really cool. It's something I always wanted to do. Never, ever would I have dreamed that I would be able to do that in this life. Take a step back further, and that's not really important. I'm just telling anybody that's here that's new that you can pursue dreams, and eventually they'll come if you work for them. Every morning, I get up and I ask God for His will, and that He take away my obsession to drink, use, smoke cigarettes too. I ask for that obsession to be removed. That's an obsessive thing, you know, God. But it works. At the end of the day, I thank God for allowing me to go through that day that His will was that I did not drink, did not alter my mind, and that I didn't smoke. And then I kind of climb back up into my bed. Gets harder. Knees are a little sore. And I try to go to sleep, which 4 or 5 hours a night seems to work for me anymore. Still ticks me off that I can't sleep like I did when I was a teenager. When I first got sober, well, you could pull one off for 10 or 12 hours on a weekend, right? I can't do that anymore. I came to this program and I've met a lot of people. And many of them I've known for a long, long time. One of the benefits of being involved in this program and working this program is you'll meet people that will become your friends, that you will never understand how great a bond you could have with another human being until you come here and you're honest and sincere and you give what you have of yourself to them and they give it back to you. It creates great freedoms in life, and it creates great confidence in knowing that there's somebody there with you. I've gone through some really wild stuff in sobriety, as we all have, and I didn't go back to drink or anything. I turned to the people that I've known. And it might seem like you're wobbling, you're falling back and forth. They're there. Maybe they're not going to fix everything for you. They're going to be there for you. They're going to be sober there with you. Those are the great things that happen. I met a girl in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got married to a girl in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had kids with a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it didn't work out. We chose different paths in the program, so to speak. We're not married anymore. I love her because she put these two great kids in my life. Sorry. There were some struggles, legal struggles that went on through some of those things. And what ended up happening was the court gave me those daughters. And so I've had them and raised them as a single dad, which I would say I'd be proud of it, but it's not really all me. It's what I was just saying. It's your friends. It's the support. It's the people that you've met when you've been around here and worked this program that have been there to help you through some of those times. I went 60 some odd days without seeing them because before everything went and got straightened out through the courts, they were put out of my life. I didn't do anything to deserve it, but it's what happened. Hardest 60 some odd days of my sober life. That's done. Their mom, I'll hug her, I'll tell her I love her because she put the kids in my life. They've reestablished a relationship and her life seems to be going pretty good right now. So that is kind of nice to see that happen. Having these kids in my life, though, has been like an unbelievable experience. And there's that fear thing and stuff. Will I be able to do it? Well, can I raise these kids? Can I take them to the dance studio? Can I take them to the dance practice? But it all worked out. They're really cool girls. This last August, God, my friends in this fellowship or whatever, I took my oldest daughter to school in Colorado. Weirdest thing is, after you take her and you come back, the door to her room stays open instead of closed. And when you wake up in the morning, she's not there. She's here, but she's not there. She's over there, but she's still here. I had to go through that. It's not fun, but it's real. This program makes you think and do things that you really don't know that you might think, say, or do. Somebody asked me, "Oh, how can you let your baby go?" And you know, and all this stuff. And the words came to me as that, you know, how could I deny the world the opportunity to come to know her? Cool kid. Same thing with my youngest one. I'll have to deal with that in about a year and a half. This one tells me she wants to go all the way to the East Coast. That's a long way from California, you know. Will I do it? Yeah. Will I accept it? Of course I will. Will I like it? Not so much. Will I be happy for her? Yes, I will. Is she going to be safe? Yeah, God's going to keep an eye on her. I think she's got the right set of tools. Both of my kids have known me nothing more than to be a sober parent. They've never seen me in another state. That's a gift. That's what the program will allow you. It allowed me to go and endure some really difficult situations and do them sober and come up with the right things to say or do based upon the feedback that I might get or that I will get from the other people that I've come to know in this program. I come up with some of them myself, too. I don't totally rely on everybody. I certainly turn into God on every major decision in my life and ask you, you know, whatever your will is, let's go. You guys ever do that? Hang on like the rope and just say, all right, this one's God, so I'm going to let him take care of it. The reality is, every one of those things that I've ever turned over to God, which is my life on a daily basis, worked out. I didn't drink. And all the other silly little creepy, funny, insane, whatever it is, things that happen out there in the world, didn't really matter if I did what I was supposed to do that day, which created what I would consider to be a successful day, and that would be not drink, to be sober that day. Some wise guy told me that a long time ago that, you know, doesn't matter what happened during the course of your day, if you didn't drink, that's successful if you're an alcoholic. Your day was an absolute success if you're an alcoholic and you didn't drink. Put down to the simplest terms, now I don't like it that much that way because, see, I've got, you know, way too many other ideas of how things are supposed to go because, remember, I came here, I was really smart, okay? I came here and listened to other people that had been here longer than me that were actually wiser. Not smarter, wiser. And thank God I did. When do I get to pull the plug on this?
When you're ready.
Okay. Go ahead, you can all have a drink of your coffee and water now. I don't know how to close these things up other than, you know, to just try to throw a few things out there. And there, you know, you may have heard some things here, and I certainly pull me aside after the meeting if you need any clarity, because I will tell you that everything I gave you up here was sincere, honest, and truthful. I may not remember everything I said to you, but it was sincere, honest, and truthful. Alcoholics Anonymous provides a way for an alcoholic to save his life. Anybody that's in here that wants to argue with me, we're going toe-to-toe on that one. What you do with it when you get here is entirely up to you. There's got to be 50 million, 75 million different ways to work this program without drinking. I think the simplest thing that I found out of this thing is, thy will be done, not mine. When I develop a concept of a higher power, which I got through working the steps, not even talk about that stuff, but you guys got to do this stuff. You know that. To develop the concept that it's thy will, not mine. And that's my short, one of my short prayers. Thy will, not mine. Thy will, not mine. Thy will, not mine. You ever see me walking around on some street corner doing those kinds of things? That's what happens, you know, is I'm just looking for something. But this program will allow you to find an avenue to a higher power that can create a life for you you never dreamed possible. It has allowed me, and it has allowed many of us, and probably all of us in this room, one way or another, an answer or a solution to every problem or situation that arises in our sober life. Have you picked up the phone and called your friend because you felt bad about something that was going on? Did you walk into a meeting feeling lousy but sat in that seat and told yourself, I'm supposed to be here, and felt good about the fact that you were? These are stupid little things that I think of that I do. I've hit some dark spots and sat in chairs in meetings, just quietly sat there and felt good about the fact that I was there because I needed to be there. I might not have shared or participated in the meeting with the group that way, but I participated with the group by just being in there and listening. I might hear something that's going to help me. The fact of the matter is I didn't sit there in god-awful fear in the back of my house or my car or whatever it is and wonder how I was going to get out of this one. I went to a place in a room where there were people that are like me, that are alcoholics, that are wanting to be there for the reason that I wanted to be there too, because I don't want to drink. I want to be sober. I want to continue to go forward in my life and to be given these unbelievably tremendous gifts that all go down to a simple thing called sobriety. That's why I showed up. That's why I show up. Answers come when your own house is in order, even if you don't put your clothes in the hamper. That's me. There's just solutions and answers here. Most recently, and my mom passed away at the end of October, October 28th to be exact. And I miss her. Quite a spirit, quite a character, but also became reliant upon me because I got sober and stayed sober. And I was a good son. I know I was a good son. I asked God to guide me through a lot of things that I had to deal with her and the things that she went through. this was really cool and gave me a few things to really think about going forward in my life. They diagnosed her. It was a cancer that had come back on her, and so I was down there with the doctor when she was in the hospital. And the doctor said, "Okay, well, you got to make some decisions. You want to go through with the surgery again?" And she had ovarian cancer, and the other one now in the stomach, and so it was pretty big and pretty bad, you know. And he said, go through a surgery. It's a pretty major deal, and then we'll go through chemotherapy. And he says you'll have to make some decisions. And she opted not to do that. And he says, "Okay, I understand that." She's 79 years old and, you know, weak and all that. And she looked at me and I said, "I support your decision." What am I supposed to say? "No, you got to get cut open and go through chemotherapy." She made a decision, and that's what she gets to do. So she kind of sits there, and I said to the doctor, I have to ask the question, what do we got here time-wise? What can we expect? 1 to 3 weeks, maybe a month, he says. I'm kind of like, oh, like this. Here's my mom. Thumbs up, looks at me and says, "I'm going home soon." There's faith. I said, "Yeah, you are. I'll be with your dad." "Yeah, you will." "Here, my son," touches my face. Kind of goes right through you and stays there. And she thanks me for being who I was. So, first thing that comes up in the back of my mind is, why am I like this? Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.